Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome into the second hour of Darren Donick and Chase. Willie Donick, Marquise Munson, Elijah Campbell today with Darren and Chase taking a long weekend. We press on. We've got some great stuff coming up on the show. As we promised you earlier, time to talk to Adam Vingan from The Athletic. He covers the Nashville Predators as the NHL has now gone to their phase two with the players able to work out on the ice in small groups, working towards, hopefully, the start of training camp around July the 10th. Adam, welcome to the show.
Who gets top billing in this situation? Is it Willie, Marquise, and Elijah? Marquise, Willie, and Elijah? Elijah, Willie, and Marquise? What's the order here?
Yeah, it's a one-day lineup, so I don't know that we have billing, so to speak. It's a mini, it's a sideshow. It's a side billing.
We're G League.
There's a small sign, yeah.
Me and Elijah are G League players, so we're just playing our rotation right now. When coach says put them in, we just go in and play.
It's our call-up day. We're the Admirals right now.
It's like when Mad Dog Russo, the one day that Mike Francesa was out at WFAN, changed the Mike and the Mad Dog song and angered Mike Francesa to the point that he threatened to quit. So I was just wondering if it was sort of like that.
Yeah, Elijah, we need a new intro.
We should have done that. Hey, me and you are both on tomorrow. We can hijack it then.
Yeah, we can do that. Sorry, Willie.
Well, let's delve in to a couple of things that Adam has been working on here. Adam, you got a chance along with the Nashville media to talk to the captain, Roman Josi. Give us your thoughts as they move ahead here, and they're going at a fairly deliberate pace here. They want to make sure they don't do too much too fast. I had in my mind that when phase two happened, you'd have more of a percentage of each team in their home city working out together, but it's not going to happen quite as quick as it might seem.
No, and if I recall the press conference correctly, because I asked Roman specifically how many of his teammates were in town holding these informal workouts, and he said roughly 10. And that was the other interesting thing as well is, Roman was talking about players working at a different facility. You know, members of the media were asking about Bridgestone Arena and I suppose Centennial Sportsplex. But Roman was talking about how he and his teammates were training at a unspecified location and they had not yet re-entered the Predators facility. So perhaps that could happen soon. I mean, you see it on social media. A lot of teams have been welcoming their players back to their respective arenas and practice facilities to hold these informal workouts. So I'm not sure when they're going to transition from these informal workouts to these voluntary workouts, which I guess are the same thing, but you know what I mean, in terms of being in the facility, whether it be Bridgestone or Centennial.
You know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of flexibility given, I think, to the players just make sure you're skating. You're clear to skate. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of communication with strength coaches, conditioning, on how they go about it. And I'm not just talking about the Predators. I'm talking about with every team in the league because you literally still have people all around the globe. There's a lot of logistics here. And eventually, by towards the end of this month, you would hope that everybody is closer to being back in their town, right? So that they can start looking forward to July 10th, because that's the key date that everybody's got to be ready to go in enough shape to start a training camp.
What I think is interesting is that the NBA, I believe, has a specified date in which players have to return to their home cities to begin training camp. I think it was either this week or early next week, but there was a specific date that NBA players had to return to their, you know, where their team plays. We haven't seen that date in the NHL yet, which I think is interesting. I'm wondering if they are trying to get as close to July 10th as possible before making that decision in terms of, okay, we need every player to be back in their city by whatever date. But I do find it interesting that the NHL hasn't made that decision public yet. And I spoke to Matthew Shane a couple of days ago for an unrelated story, and he mentioned to me that around Memorial Day, he and his young family chartered a plane and went back to Haliburton, Ontario. And he decided that he just thought it would be safer up in his cottage area, just because there are so fewer people in Lake Country Canada than there are in Nashville. So he and his wife and his young son went back up north. And when I asked him at what point he feels like he'll have to come back to town, he didn't give me a specific answer, but said he has a plan in mind based on July 10th in terms of the training he's doing, when he would like to get back to Nashville, when he would want to be quarantined before going into the facilities, et cetera. So I know these players are planning like July 10th is the date for right now.
Adam, in the meantime, we're still piecing together different things, trying to keep ourselves occupied before the action starts, and we still got a ways to go for sure. And there's only so much, you know, you can do in terms of, you know, waiting for the practices to start. So you had the voting that's been going on here. You've written about that. Something you also decided to tackle. I thought this was humorous based on all the history of this. The last go around of the expansion draft. Yeah. How many funny things we had that were going on. The reaction to different things, but. You know, I do imagine that the Predators have looked at this down the road. Eventually, they have to prepare what they're going to do when the expansion draft comes around and Seattle starts selecting players. So you actually took a run at that for the first time. So mark the date.
Right. The expansion draft is scheduled for next June. Though I wonder if that might change because of the after effects of the coronavirus pandemic in terms of the NHL schedule. But at The Athletic, we're going to run another version of our Seattle mock draft, which we've done a couple of times. I think that's going to publish within the next week or two. So I wanted to get ahead of that by putting together my third edition of my Predators protection list. The first one I did in December of 2018, and the second one I did last July. So this was my third attempt. And what I decided to do this time was use both options of protection, the 8 skaters and 1 goaltender, and the 7 forwards, 3 defensemen, and 1 goaltender option. Of course, the Predators were one of 7 teams in the Vegas draft to protect 8 skaters instead of 7 forwards and 3 defensemen. But one thing that came up as I was doing this exercise, especially for the 7 forwards, 3 defensemen, 1 goaltender option, was which one of the Predators' big defensemen are you leaving out to dry, so to speak? And I wondered if Mattias Ekholm might be the player who would, the big name player that might be left exposed if the Predators do a 7-3-1 protection list, just because he'll be 31 at the time. He'll have 1 year left on his contract. He's in line for a big raise because of how steady of a defender he is. But you have Roman Josi and Ryan Ellis signed for close to the next decade as big money contracts. So it might be time to move on from one of those big defensemen. So I wonder if the Predators would ever consider that, considering they were one of a few teams to protect 4 defensemen last time.
Well, that, I think, is the most intriguing part from what we learned that Vegas did, right? And at the time, the Predators had the 4 ace defensemen. They just could not. They could not cope with leaving one of the 4 exposed. But right. When you go 7-3-1, you do have so much more flexibility in who you save amongst your forwards. I mean, how can you possibly not leave a pretty good forward sitting there like James Neal the last time if you protect the 4 defensemen? So that's the part that intrigued me, Adam, because in a year, I think we have to find out, you know, how much progress does Dante Fabbro make. Right? Is he worth protecting? I think they certainly think he's a valuable guy that's going to be around for a long, long time. And then how do they feel about their ability to re-sign Mattias Ekholm, and what's his value at age 31? Those are the two critical questions.
Yes. And you know, when I did the 4-4-1 method, the 4 forwards, 4 defensemen, 1 goaltender option, I chose to protect Ryan Johansson, Victor Arvidsson, Matthew Shane, and Philip Forsberg. Now, that is, of course, subject to change. There was a commenter on the story this morning who made a very fair assessment that Ryan Johansson should be exposed in the expansion draft, and that is something I guess worth talking about at some point. But, you know, if they were to protect those four forwards, that leaves a Colton Sissons, you know, a Callie Yarncrow, a Craig Smith or Mikael Granlund if one of them is re-signed. I mean, it leaves Connor Ingram exposed. He is eligible for the expansion draft. So there are going to be more, they're going to be more experienced goaltenders than Connor Ingram, but, you know, he'll have upside at that stage of his career. But, you know, I think Colton Sissons seems like a perfect, perfect expansion choice because he's, you know, he's young, he's 20, he's in his late 20s. He plays every position on every line. He has, at that time, he'll have 5 years left on his contract, under $3 million per season. I mean, he's the perfect player for an expansion franchise, I feel like. And the Predators know how important a player like Sissons is, so losing him would certainly be risky.
We're talking to Adam Vingan of The Athletic. Now, Adam, you mentioned Ryan Johansson, and he joined Preds Insiders earlier this week, and he talked about playing his best hockey in the postseason. And he jokingly said, you know, wanting to prove the haters wrong. So is he one of those guys that going into this season or this postseason could really be one of those breakout players for the Preds that may have struggled in the regular season and can help the Preds move forward in this postseason?
Well, he better be. Because a $36.8 million number one center does not get you anywhere, which is what Ryan Johansson was during the regular season. But he is absolutely right that the postseason brings out the best in him. I mean, I'll always remember a conversation I had with him during the 2017 playoffs after the first round but before the second round. So, and I was talking to him about the importance of this postseason for him, and he looked back at his performance against Jonathan Toews in the first round in the sweep of the Blackhawks, and he felt like that was his first true statement to the NHL, that up against a multiple-time Stanley Cup-winning, celebrated captain, he dominated him on the biggest possible stage. And he carried that with him throughout the postseason, and we saw how great he was shutting down top players against the St. Louis Blues and the Anaheim Ducks before he was injured. But there are multiple players who I think that will be benefited by this break. We've talked about Victor Arvidsson health-wise. We've talked about Pekka Rinne mentally. And I think Ryan Johansson falls into that mental category as well. I think the mental game is going to be even more important this postseason than in other postseasons because of the changes in play and not playing in front of fans and the effects that that can have. So, you know, Ryan Johansson, this team will only go as far as he takes them. So to answer your question, he better be ready.
So speaking of changes, obviously, you know, changing in coaching staff and, you know, the Preds, you know, got on a hot streak with John Hines before the pandemic actually started. And being a new coach with a new team, do you think he's benefiting from this break? Because now he can kind of get his players together. He can have a training camp and kind of figure everything out going into the postseason.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I talked to John Hines within the past month or so. And, you know, I brought up to him a set of articles I did right after the season was suspended where I looked at some statistics comparing John Hines to Peter Laviolette in multiple categories. And one thing that John Hines stressed from his first day as Predators coach was the need to be more dangerous in the offensive zone, particularly in the middle of the ice, and defending the slot area in the defensive zone. And the statistics that I found showed that the Predators had noticeable regression in those areas between Peter Laviolette and John Hines. And when I talked to him about it, you know, the reason why he felt like is they didn't have time to adjust because they remember John Hines coached the game the night that he was hired. So they didn't really have a lot of time, a lot of practice time to implement these ideas. And now they've had the past 3.5 months to work with these players, show them video. And when they get on the ice and have a training camp, he can further implement those ideas. So what we're seeing on the ice will look a bit smoother, I think, with this break.
Adam, I know you enjoyed the NBA setup in Orlando, right? Because it is just,
oh, I love it.
It is fantastic. And
the only thing that will make it better, I'm sorry for interrupting, is if the players and families can actually go into Disney World.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I saw a report that they might open some rides for them. Now that would be sick. Everything else is awesome.
I mean,
but, like, be able to basically have a free in to Disney World when no one else can go in would be pretty sick.
I mean, you already got free movies. They're getting Black Widow for free, and before it comes out in theaters for everybody else, they're going to get to watch it for free. So, hey, kudos to them. But, you know, what was your favorite rule of the NBAs? Like, what was the favorite thing that you took out from it?
I think I saw something that was tweeted that broke down the activities that the players could do, and one of them was talking about ping pong. And there was a rule in the memo that said that people should not participate in doubles ping pong in order to maintain social distancing. So they were restricting ping pong to one-on-one only, no doubles.
That's going to be a nice one-on-one tournament, though, for ping pong. Let's see, some NBA players are going to compete in that. But Adam, speaking of, so when you look at the NBA setup, do you see the NHL possibly doing something similar with their hub cities? And do you see, out of the 10, 11 hub cities that were named, do you see one that can kind of fit the similar plan that the NBA has?
Yes, I do, and I think it's one of the front runners at this point, and that's Las Vegas. And, you know, you've seen videos, I'm sure, on social media since Las Vegas reopened of people shoulder to shoulder in casinos, just like old times, with no regard for their own health and safety, as well as those of others. But, you know, the thing that's nice about the Las Vegas setup is the arena, T-Mobile Arena, is right in the smack dab in the Strip, plenty of hotels within walking distance. And I wonder what the NHL might do. Like, for example, would they, for lack of a better term, like rent out a casino, an entire casino floor or a wing of a casino and only have it available to players and families and staff and whatever? I think the most important thing is just to make sure that these players don't feel like they're living between their hotel room and a rink for, you know, 2.5-3 months. Certainly they're going to want to have some fun. So I'm hoping that the NHL at least takes some cues from the NBA.
Speaking of the NBA, Adam, I'm going to ask you this question now. What is more likely to happen?
All right.
Roman Josi winning the Norris Trophy or Zion Williamson winning Rookie of the Year?
Oh, man.
Oh, loaded.
At this point, it's going to be Roman Josi winning the Norris Trophy.
Okay, good answer.
Despite my hopes of Zion, but as we discussed a couple months ago, you know, apparently the number of games he played is going to be held against him, which, of course, I don't think it should be held against him.
Yes, it should.
And I look forward to whatever play-in round the Western Conference playoff has when the Pelicans win the 8th seed and then upset the Lakers in the first round of the NBA playoffs.
Wow, you're just trying to frustrate me. I think that's what you did. I thought you were going to say Grizzlies, but you just went way ahead of that. And
you had
said,
us till the end. Yeah, you had us till the end, and then I think you pushed it a little too far.
The Pelicans.
Well, that is something we're going to talk at noon. Yeah, we're going to talk about this at noon with Pete Pranica from the Grizzlies television broadcast, because the Pelicans with Zion Williamson will be competing a lot with the Grizzlies to see maybe who does play the Lakers in the first round of the playoffs. It's shaping up that way. We'll get into that. So, Adam, in the meantime, thanks for coming on. Good stuff as always, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
All right, guys. Thanks.
All right, that's Adam Vingan. When we come back, we're going to get Marquise's case for the NBA Rookie of the Year, and I'll give the case for Roman Josi for the Norris Trophy. We'll have a little fun with that. And as I mentioned before, we're going to talk to Pete Pranica at noon. We'll also have Joe Rexroad from The Athletic at 12:30 today. Another thing we'll get into later this hour is college football. They announced sort of a return to play practice schedule, but there are some things popping up here and there from some different areas of players testing positive for the virus, and how to try to navigate through all of that as they continue to try to move towards a football season. There's certainly some things to talk about. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming here on 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase. In our next segment, we will talk a little college football. Jeremy Pruitt has been addressing the media the last few minutes. We'll tell you about some tidbits, including one of the things that he and his staff were doing with his players, which is make sure everybody is registered to vote. I think that's a great thing. And that's an important thing for everybody to do. If you want to actually have some change, and if you desire change, then that is a very, very important element to it. And that is to make sure you are registered to vote. Regardless of which way you want to vote, who you want to vote for, you got to register to vote. You got to participate. Another college football tidbit we will discuss, Texas announcing that 13 of their players have tested positive for the coronavirus. We'll get to that a little bit later in the hour. But first, I want to give Marquise the floor. He brought it up with Adam Ving, and there are a couple of really interesting votes that are going to take place involving players from our area. A, will Ja Morant from the Grizzlies indeed be the NBA's Rookie of the Year? And will Roman Josi of the Predators be the Norris Trophy winner in the NHL for the NHL's best defenseman? So, Marquise, first of all, let me ask you this. But as I give you the floor to make your case for Ja, does the play-in to the playoffs, the games they will play between now and the time that the actual playoffs start and the NBA's restart, will they count towards the voting, or will everybody vote before that starts?
No, I think the eight games that they play before the playoffs will count as regular season games. So those games will count. However, I think you get a slight boost if you are that 8-9 seed that are playing. So let's say, for example, Ja Morant and Zion, the Pelicans and the Grizzlies play in that 8-9 seed where you pretty much get two or three extra games. I think then, you know, that will still count as a regular season game. So those games will count. Hopefully they just make the whole playoffs count, and then we can really determine who's the MVP and who's – I've always been a component of them doing the stuff after the season's over with, so they can really get a true who's MVP and who's not, or who's Rookie of the Year and who's not.
Because one of the reasons I'm asking is – one of the issues that has come up a bunch is the amount of games that Zion Williamson actually has played, because he has made a giant impact on that team since he's been in there. But obviously he missed a ton of games. So the more he plays and the more he has a body of work, the more that's going to influence the vote. Whereas Ja Morant's been there, he did miss a few games. And in fact, you saw a massive drop off in the Grizzlies' play in the handful of games he missed early in the season. But, the number of games that Zion plays will play into it. So make your case on who the Rookie of the Year should be.
All right, look, I understand people's hype over Zion, and it is great. Both of the, and I want to start this off by saying, both of these guys are going to be great. They are both the best players on each respective team. They are going to be the stars of their respective teams for years to come. All stars. I can see more awards for these guys in the near future. However, this year, let's focus on this year. Zion has been on a streak. He's become the first rookie to average 23 points per game since Allen Iverson, and, you know, and that was 23 years ago. You know, he's the third rookie, you know, to even put up 28 points and 8 rebounds. And the only three other rookies to do that was Wilt Chamberlain and Joel Embiid. So he's in some pretty high stakes up there. However, we have to take into account how many games he's played. And we can't do the whole, what if he would have been healthy? If he would have been healthy, I think he would have been still putting up these numbers. We can't be doing what ifs. We got to be focused on what's going on now. And right now, and for the beginning of the NBA season, Ja Morant has been the best rookie in the league. And this has been a league full of good rookies. You know, Tyler Hero and Kendrick Nunn, they've been having a good season. Even Ja Morant's teammate Brandon Clark has had a good season as well. However, when you look at Ja Morant, and he is averaging 17 points a game, he's averaging over six assists a game, close to seven. He is 13th in the league in assist. He has got a team. This Grizzlies team was supposed to tank in the beginning of the season. We talked about that this time last year when they drafted Ja Morant, about how this team was in a rebuilding process. They got to get a new coach in Taylor Jenkins. And, you know, they're going to rebuild. They got Andre Iguodala. He's going to be the veteran. This is like a salary dump team, pretty much. That's how we looked at the Grizzlies going into it. And they're an 8 seed. I think if the season would have played out the way it did, like a normal season, I think they could have climbed up. They could have probably climbed up to a 7 seed. I think all of that is partly due to Ja Morant. Yeah, the Pelicans are in playoff contention. I understand that. Is Zion the reason for that? Well, you have to be kind of in the bubble of playoff contention to be in playoff contention. And they were in that before Zion got there. So we got to give a lot of credit to Brandon Ingram, who's probably going to win Most Improved Player of the Year this year. He's kind of kept that Pelicans team in that bubble. Him, Drew Holiday, Lonzo, those guys really help keep them in that line and keep them in that playoff contention. And once Zion come back, that was kind of like the icing on the cake to their playoff race. So Ja Morant has done it from October all the way to now, and he's still doing it, and the Grizzlies are still in playoff hunt, and that's why Ja Morant should win Rookie of the Year. Give it to him.
I'm in total agreement. I think it should be hands down, but I always wonder how the votes are going to go. What's in the minds of the voters when it comes down to
absolutely.
This? How do they view it?
And you mentioned it with Yossi like a lot, and I know you're going to get to that too, of like you don't know the mentality of some of these voters, and I hope some of these voters don't have that what if. Well, if Ja Morant, you know, played 10 games less and, you know, Zion played 20 games more, then they kind of would have been even and Zion would have. Hopefully they don't vote that way. Hopefully they vote on what they've seen from the whole season, from the season that started in October and ended when it's going to end, whenever these 8 games are done. Hopefully they judge it based off of that and not these what if Zion was healthy, he would have still been putting up these numbers, because we don't know that. He could have been putting up these numbers in the beginning of the season and got hurt again. We don't know. So that's why I say let's do it based off of the resume that you have in place, and that resume says that Ja Morant is Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Ja Morant's the Rookie of the Year. I don't think he's the best rookie in the NBA, if that makes sense. Before we toss it to Willie, I will say there is some precedent to a rookie missing a lot of games and winning Rookie of the Year. Brandon Roy, when he won Rookie of the Year, missed about 25 games. But I think Zion's number of missed games is a little higher than what Brandon Roy's was. But Willie, I guess it's time for you to make your case for Roman Yossi, which might be a little harder considering him and John Carlson played the same amount of games, and the casual fan would look at their stat lines and see that John Carlson has 10 more points than Roman Yossi. How would Yossi be able to overcome that argument for the Norris?
Yeah, this is a different argument, but it arrives at the same conclusion for me that in my eyes, it's clear cut. And am I influenced by the fact that I watch Roman Yossi every night? There's no question. I've watched him, you know, 100 more times than I have a guy like John Carlson, who is a great player. And as you mentioned, he's got the most points. But I would hope that you are examining the entire body of work of a defenseman. Now, the key word is defenseman, right? Your job on defense is not only to score points. It's your entire job scoring points within the context of your first job, which is, you know, shutting down the opposition's top players and things like that. So my argument is twofold. A, the eye test. When you watch Roman Yossi, he jumps off the page and things that he can do that nobody else can do. So the eye test goes to Roman Yossi, which is ironic because we are now in this age where we're looking at so many stats. And so let's look at the stats. That's the second part of it. If you just look at points and you just look at the fact that the Capitals have done better as a team than the Predators, then you're going to have people, if they go by that, they will vote for Carlson. So you have to go to another level for Yossi. And I'll start with the intangible. The Predators would not have been in playoff position without the play of Roman Yossi this year. He carried the Predators, and I would point to a stretch right before Christmas where the team was really struggling, and he really put them on their shoulders. It had a very important road stretch after a tough debacle against the Dallas Stars in mid-December. The only time they played the Stars before the Winter Classic, it put everybody with a bad taste in their mouth. He put them up on their shoulders. They won the 2 games in New York. They won in Boston. He had a spectacular goal in Ottawa to get them to overtime in a game that they didn't play very well otherwise. Those are the types of performances to me that should be noted. But again, it doesn't even get to me, his strongest case, and that is the analytics. What do you do in the full package all the way around? I won't bore you with all of the zone time and the zone entries and offensive rushes where he's number one, hands down, and way, way outperforms John Carlson. But I'll put it into one stat. Don Lucision, who is representative of The Athletic, he does an analytics stat where he puts really all the things that you do into one number. Think war in baseball, wins above replacement. Well, he's got a stat basically that takes all of the elements of a defenseman and ranks them accordingly. Roman Josi ranks number one in that category. John Carlson is not number two. He's number nine in that. And that illustrates John Carlson's game. He's a great player. He excels in putting up points, which is why he leads the NHL in points by a defenseman. He's got the most points by a defenseman per game of anybody in something like 25 years. So it's notable. But when you look at the other things, defensive part of the game, penalty killing, how do you do against the best players? All of the things that are taken into account, he goes down a little bit. He's good, but he's not great. Roman Josi excels in all facets of the game. So to me, that's why it should be clear-cut. But I do, just like we're talking about with the NBA voters, how simple do you look at it? Do you look at it in depth? Or do you say, hey, Capitals have had a really good year. They've got more points as a team than the Predators. And John Carlson's got the most points. I'll vote for John Carlson. If it's that simple, we got a problem. If you look at it with detail, then it's clearly Roman Josi.
And to add to your statistical argument as well, Hockey Reference breaks up each team's wins into like win shares. They have offensive win shares, defensive win shares to kind of divvy up the credit for a team's success. And obviously, John Carlson has more offensive win shares, or point shares, I should say, with 7.2 to Josi 6.1. However, on defensive point shares, Josi has him 4.8 to 3.5, and he has more point shares overall, too. So even Hockey References metrics do conclude that Roman Josi's defense has been more valuable to scoring and preventing points than John Carlson's explosive offensive season.
So there you have it. We have weighed in. I know I'm probably preaching to the choir to most of our listeners on that, but I'm laying out what the issues are going to be. And we're going to talk to Elliot Friedman at 1 o'clock. He has had to put his ballot in. Last time we talked to him, he said he was still mulling over. Is it Josi or is it Carlton? Maybe he'll tell us who he voted for at 1 o'clock. Make sure you tune in for that. When we come back, though, we will talk about what's going on with college football. There's some things happening right now. We'll tell you what the NCAA announced yesterday in terms of practice and leading up to the first game and what some of the teams are dealing with individual things as the players get back to the campus and get in their housing and start the workouts, etc. So a lot to discuss. That's coming up in our next segment here on 102.5 The Game. Coming at you here on 102.5 The Game. Darren Donick and Chase. Willie Donick, Marquise Munson, Elijah Campbell today here with you. Darren and Chase have the day off. They'll be back with us on Monday. College football made some announcements yesterday. We're going to get into some of the issues that are going on with them. In a lot of cases, over in Knoxville, I've been watching some tweets, some tidbits that have come out from Jeremy Pruitt's press conference today as the players arrive back on campus and start working out. So let's get to the particulars of what happened with the announcement yesterday from the committee that's been working on this from the NCAA's perspective. Marquise, tell us what you got.
Yeah, so basically the NCAA Council approved a 6-week practice plan for football to begin July and will transition teams from their current voluntary workouts amid the coronavirus stuff to temporary mandatory meetings and a preseason camp to prepare for the 2020 season. Now, basically, this includes, you know, with walk-on players, and most of a football team is constructed of 120 to 130 players. So, but during this typical 4-week preseason that will begin in August, teams will be allowed only 110 to return to camp. Now, players will be allowed up to 20 hours of countable athletic-related activities per week, including up to 1 hour each day for a walkthrough. The players won't be allowed to wear helmets or pads during the walkthroughs, but they can use a football pretty much. So for the teams that begin the season on Labor Day, they're required to begin their workouts on July 13th following an enhanced training schedule that begins July 24th and a normal four-week preseason camp starting August 7th. So schools that open the season on August 29th will have to be required to do their workouts on July 6th. So basically, if the team plays on the 29th, we're going to get people back on the field and back practicing in this six-week program in July 6th.
And Elijah, as this is happening, as they're laying out the groundwork and the game plan for the most part, as players are getting back to start doing the workouts and getting to the campus, they're trying to do an assessment of, is everybody healthy? They're obviously having to test people, but Texas made an announcement today that definitely has you raising your eyebrows.
Yeah, 13 players upon return to their campus in Austin tested positive for COVID-19. And this is something that Houston is dealing with, too. Houston had to cancel their voluntary workout program over the summer because during the time they got to campus and the time they were conducting their workouts, they had six players test positive for COVID-19. So there's plans in place. But for me, what's the plan for after you have one player or multiple players test positive? I think that's going to be the biggest hurdle. And that's to me the most important thing to be addressed, because I don't think it's a matter of if someone's going to test positive. At this case, with the way this thing is spreading, it's a matter of when. And team or schools specifically need to have a plan in place for when that happens, so you don't just have to like close shop, kind of like what Houston did.
I would imagine, Marquise, as players come back from their communities, that this is going to happen to a number of teams. There's going to be a certain amount of people that have contracted the virus. So the question becomes, A, you've got to have your protocol for those people to stay in isolation, quarantine until they're cleared. Then once everybody is in your environment every day, how do you keep there from being another outbreak? This is going to be a constant challenge as we go forward here. We'll talk about Dr. Fauci's comments that have gotten everybody alarmed as far as what's coming for the NFL. But the reality is it's going to be a constant threat, and you've got to stay on top of it. I think the coach's thought is, this is at least what has been relayed to us. We were talking to Adam Rittenberg from ESPN about this yesterday, that the coaches feel like once they get everybody there, they have a better chance of controlling the virus spread than if everybody's in their own hometowns and doing kind of their own thing.
Yeah, but I would also think, what's going to happen when school starts back up? Are these kids going to be in class? Or
challenge.
It's all these things. So the NFL, they can easily, get by this because, obviously the players aren't going to class or anything with a bunch of people. So how is that going to work? If your campus is opening up to students, you're going to have those same students around student athletes. And then those student athletes are going to be around their team. So that's going to be the question, is how do you manage all of that? Do you keep teams in a bubble? Do you, on campus where it's like an off, where teachers can come to them and teach them, or do they do online classes? Like, how is that? What's that going to take? And then also, you have meetings with your staff. Like, let's say, for example, one safety catches the coronavirus and he's in a room full of the safeties. Are you going to have to check all those guys that are in that position group? And then are they going to have to do a 14-day quarantine after one of your players contracts the virus? And are you going to have to do the whole defense that way too? Because obviously if you're in the safety groups and you're already doing your individual group stuff, but you're going to also do stuff with your defense. So are you going to have to test them too? So it's just so many questions surrounding how they're going to be able to manage players getting the virus. Now, right now it's just, look, players getting the virus, they're at home or they're on campus, we'll keep them in quarantine. So right now I'm not saying it's fine that they get the virus now, but it's going to be a lot challenging when you have your players, let's say like Alabama had five players, and you have those five players around your whole entire team. So that's going to be the biggest question, is how they're going to manage and how are they going to keep these players protected and in a bubble.
Well, that, I don't know that you can have the bubble, but it does bring up, you know, there are some that when you start really going down this pathway of discussing all the different things that can pop up, you do wonder if they will come to the conclusion that you just can't play, or at least some people or some schools might have a set of circumstances out of all those things you just said that they just cannot play. They don't have
Absolutely.
Enough guys.
And I look at a guy like Trey Smith, like who has underlining health conditions already, you know, with what he went through with blood clots. Are you going to put him out in that situation and have him out there on the field? Is he going to sit out? What is going to be the decision, you know, he makes with this? And so those are things that you have to worry about. So, and kids that age don't know that they have, you know, underlying health conditions that could possibly affect them, because at that point they're playing football. They feel like, well, I'm athletic, so I probably don't have any health issues at all. When you're that age, that's how you think. So are we going to, you know, get these players some physicals and make sure that they don't have any of these underlying health concerns so they don't get put in a position to where they can possibly catch the virus and it can cause long-term damage to them? So it's just there's
very, very important point.
Exactly. There's just so many.
If they're doing it right, all of these things, the answer has got to be yes, and a resounding yes. I think the underlying health condition has got to be at the top of the list of things. And then I think you start going down to other things. You mentioned online classes. Well, I think in a lot of cases, there are a lot of players that were doing online classes, at least to some degree, anyway, well before the pandemic. So you might have an outline. And then what is the school doing in terms of how they're going to conduct classes? How much is each school going to have, let's just say, a room with half capacity, but you're actually in the room? Or will you just have the class via Zoom? You're sitting in your dorm room and you go on and the professor is giving it, is giving the lecture that particular day. You know, there's a lot of different things that I think the schools are working on in terms of what's their policy going to be. But I do think in order to really have a chance, I don't think you can put the players in a bubble and actually have them be students, but you're going to have to really be strict in where they're going, right? You're going to have to be watching them almost 24/7 in order to make sure that nobody is venturing out and putting themselves in an area where you could come back and infect your whole team. It's going to be hard enough when you're playing games and practicing every day and swapping, you know, and you know, having the big pile at the end of every play. That's its own thing. You can't control that. If you're going to play football, you're going to have that. But you can at least try to mitigate a ton of things the rest of the day. But the thing is, there's a lot of time we're talking about there.
Absolutely.
To try to control everybody's movements.
It's just like there's so much difference between what the college football players are going to have to worry about and what the NFL players are going to have to worry about. Cause you have students, you have classes, you have dining halls that you possibly share. Some football players share it with other athletes, but some share it with just the general, you know, population of the students. So how is that going to be implemented? Like things like that. Like it's little things like that they have to figure out, but obviously they got the step one ahead, which was, okay, these are the dates that we're going to get back on the field. We'll have to obviously figure out the rest of the things as, you know, universities implement their own rules on how they're going to put classes together and dining halls. And I'm pretty sure every university or every conference is going to be different, but that's what they're going to have to worry about next. Now they got the plan to come back on the field, and that's the positive thing. But now we have to worry about the protection of the players now.
Yeah, that's where the school is going to have to come in, too. It's not just the athletic department that's going to be burdened with this as well, because the school is going to have to kind of isolate these guys as well. And like you said, Marquise, I know at MTSU, there's some football players and basketball players that live with just regular students. So you're going to force them to all live in dorms or make them all take online classes just because, I mean, in a way, they are almost like employees of the school that aren't getting paid. So would you treat them the same way? And that's a whole other rabbit hole you can go down to as well. But school administrations are going to have to kind of step up and help out with this as well, because it's not just the athletic department's problem with this. It's going to be the entire schools as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's players that live off campus. And, you know, I know a lot of them who lived in my apartment complex who are Alabama football players and lived off campus. Do you just you know, get a dorm room, because there's plenty of dorm rooms. When you go to universities, they got plenty of buildings that they can house players in. Do you just, you know, get one, clean it up, and then have all the football players be housed in this one area to where they can get their food? And it's kind of like their own.
See, that's
like,
see, that's a tough thing, but because when you say that, Marquise, what was that dorm being used for before? Are you booting out all the other students that were staying there? And then is it one to a room? That would make sense, right? And then you're doubling the amount of space that you need if only one player can stay in one room. Because it's a good thought. Hey, let's keep all of our guys in one dorm. Let's have them one to a room. We'll have all the food here, and we'll control the bubble. We'll have at least somewhat of a bubble, more so than if they're scattered all around the campus town, right? But then what happens to all the other students? Where do they go? They got to have somewhere to live, and they're students too. So this is it's a mountain of logistical issues.
I know for Alabama's sake, they have their football players in a certain dorm every year, so they could possibly use that one. I don't know for sure if there's like general students in there, but I do know that's where like majority of the football players are housed when they first get on campus, right? Freshman and sophomore year. So maybe they can use that, and then
maybe so. And that's Alabama, right? Who has the utmost, the highest amount of resources relative to the rest of the colleges. What about schools in other places?
Absolutely,
they don't quite have that that level of resource to go to, perhaps.
Well, see, those are the questions that are being asked now that they got the on-the-field stuff figured out.
And that's just football, too. We're just talking about football right now. There'll be other fall sports that are playing, too, assuming there are a lot of athletic programs that can afford to keep some of your smaller fall sports, like women's soccer, volleyball. Like, there's really a huge problem in terms of where you're housing all of these athletes. It's going to be so hard. Just talking about from the football standpoint, you have to also consider that these schools have other type of athletic programs that they're also going to have to house as well, and it's going to cause even some crowding in a non-conventional situation, which you really don't want crowding. It's the one thing you're trying to avoid. But then you're going to have to decide who gets booted out of dorms between regular students and even volleyball and soccer players. You know, that's a decision that's going to have to be made as well.
And the first thing right in front of them, let's just take Texas, that we know they have 13 players that have tested positive. They have come clean with that. So what's the protocol to address that? Right? Is that next week going to say, well, we had 13 the first week, and now, oh boy, we've got 26, or we've got 35? Or can they successfully contain it? Because hopefully, knock on wood, there's no complications that, you know, because they're young, they're in good shape, there's no, you know, like the vast majority of the cases, you get through it, right? The COVID-19. But did any of those players have health issues? Does anybody really get struck by the virus in a really tough way? I mean, these are all questions that every single school has got to deal with here. And that's the first step, is to get that number back, get those guys through the quarantine, get them back out there without increasing the number to the rest of the group. And football has got the biggest challenges because they have the biggest group, right? They've got, in some cases, 100 players.
And it's going to be all on the coaches, too. And we're going to figure out, like, which coach, you know, because if you have Tom Herman saying, oh, I got 13 players that tested positive for corona, but just put them on the field anyway. Or if, you know, if you're another school that has a star player that's out with the corona, and you just be like, hey, he's got to sit out. So, you know, and some of these coaches, like, morally are going to have to understand, like, hey, if you got a player that's sick, man, you got to test your whole team, or we got to test the defensive side or the offensive side. Like, you know, we have to, like, figure this out. We can't be skating by. You can't be sneaking players in that, like you used to when they're hurt, and you kind of sneak them in the game. Can't be doing that stuff. You can't
do that. That mindset's got to change.
Yeah, that mindset definitely has to change.
And I'm afraid of that, right? Because the competitive instinct gets to you. Now, in July, at least you have a few months here that you're working with these things. Hopefully you have your routine, and that doesn't cloud your judgment when it's actually time to compete, if we can get to that point. All right, let's quickly get to Nate. I know he wants to ask a question this before we move forward and talk to Pete Pranica from the Grizzlies at High Noon. Nate, what's going on?
Hey, guys. Quickly, I just wanted to say I saw an article, I guess it was a few days ago. I don't remember if it was from the CDC or who it was from, but some of the health experts said that it is very rare for the virus to get spread from an asymptomatic person to other people. So I wonder what everyone's thinking on that around the college sports landscape is going to be.
Yeah,
asymptomatic. Go ahead, Marquise.
Well, I think personally, so when you're in these meetings, like I doubt these guys are going into position group meetings without masks on. Like I think that should be a procedure and that should happen. So you avoid that situation. I heard something with the NFL that they're going to do specialty helmets possibly to where they have face covering. So you avoid that. So I think it's not going to be at practice possibly. It's more so going to be the surrounding areas of outside of practice.
Okay.
I think they'll figure out the ways to control it from their end, but they just got to make sure the players are smart and half of them or majority of them are smart enough to figure out that, hey, outside of this, let's avoid, you know, going out to large bars on Saturday doing these things. Like you
how disciplined can they be?
Yeah.
How much discipline can they have? And the asymptomatic thing is another thing. And Nate, we'll let you go on this because we got to run. But the asymptomatic part of this is probably the trickiest thing that everybody is dealing with, is that when you have somebody that's asymptomatic, it's hard to account for that, especially with the testing where it is. You know, you can't test somebody every hour, and the accuracy of the tests are still tricky, right? It's easy when somebody comes in and they got a fever and they got a cough. It's easy to say, well, okay, you need to stay home. You need to stay over there. You don't need to be around anybody else. If somebody's feeling good, but they still could have the virus, that's the scary part.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And then they don't show symptoms for 14 or so days. Yeah. So then you have to wait on that stuff too. So it's just things like I said earlier, they figured out the plan to get on the field. They just need to figure out how to surround and protect the players that are on the field. So and once they do that, I think we'll have college football in August and September.
Let's hope. When we come back, we will talk to Pete Pranica, the TV voice of the Memphis Grizzlies, and we will discuss the NBA's return to play and the challenges in front of the Grizzlies. Stay tuned. We're coming back.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.